Before we get into today's show, talking about the psychology of the survivor social game, I want to tell you about CanvasPeople.com. CanvasPeople.com is great. They turn all of those photos that you have on your phone, maybe you're putting them up on Instagram, and then people look at them for like 5 seconds, and then they're all the way gone, and they're forgotten. CanvasPeople.com allows you to take those photos and turn them into something that will last a lifetime and into a beautiful canvas piece of artwork that you can hang on your wall. Not just great for Father's Day, great for any time of year. CanvasPeople.com has a great offer right now. They are allowing you to try out CanvasPeople.com. You can get a photo up to 11 by 14 for $0. You just pay the shipping and handling. It's less than $20 total. Just use the promo code RHAP on CanvasPeople.com. All you have to do is upload your photo. You can add filters to it and all sorts of cool stuff. Go ahead and check it out at CanvasPeople.com. The offer sounds too good to be true, but you can buy it with confidence. I've heard from so many of the listeners. They've been happy with what they've gotten from CanvasPeople.com. Nicole and I have used it as well, and we're really happy with the photo that we got back from Canvas People. So give it a shot. Get this special offer. Go to canvaspeople.com, upload your photo, select the 11 by 14 size, and use promo code RHAP in the promo code box to get that special $0 pricing. That's at canvaspeople.com with promo code RHAP. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Sestrino back here with another one of our Survivor off-season podcasts, and I think we have an interesting topic to explore. We have delved into the psychology of Survivor on a number of occasions, but today we are going to be looking at the psychology of the social game, and we have a great expert guest to talk about that with us here today. She is a psychologist and a longtime RHAP listener and a good friend. Please welcome in Amanda Rabinowitz. Amanda, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, Rob. I'm excited to talk about this today.
Amanda, this was something that was near and dear to your heart that you wanted to come on here and talk about. So first off, why this particular topic?
Well, for me, Survivor started in 2000, was my freshman year of college, and I started studying psychology and I started watching Survivor around the same time. And it's really through that hook that I got interested in the game, watching how different personalities interact, watching how group dynamics play out. So it's really just a major lens through which I see the game. And now that we have 34 seasons to talk about, there's been so many examples of, the things that I've studied and the things that I've observed professionally playing out in the game. So, it's just been a part of the Survivor experience for me from the very beginning.
And can you give the listeners some of your psychology credentials?
Sure. So I received my doctorate in psychology from Penn State in 2011. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. So that means that my specialty is in helping people who have mental health issues or psychiatric diagnoses. And my particular specialty is helping individuals recover from brain injury, coping with the cognitive and emotional consequences of brain injury. So now I'm a research faculty member at a medical school and a rehab hospital, and I spend most of my time researching new treatments to help individuals with brain injury. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about today has more to do with social psychology, which I've also studied and which has always been an interest of mine. But that's what my career is about right now.
Okay, so you and I are in the same field. I am into armchair psychology with a specialty in social media psychology. I have watched numerous YouTube videos on different facets of psychology. So it's nice to have a colleague on the podcast.
Well, there you go. And you know what, Rob, and you've saved a lot of time and anguish and tears over writing a dissertation and yes, attending all those classes. And a lot of the times you actually get things right. So, I think I'm in good company here.
Rarely. Okay. So excited to dive into all of this. Let me just quickly thank a sponsor before we get into everything. And of course, there is a whole psychology of buying a car, because in order to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price when you're buying a car, you need price and context. And that's where True Car comes in. It's information that empowers you to feel confident. With True Car, you'll see what other people are paying in your local market for the car that you want. From there, you can connect with a local True Car certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Right, Amanda? That's important. You have to feel confident when you're buying, making a big purchase like a car.
Absolutely. Any psychologist will tell you that.
Yes. So when you use True Car, they'll help you easily find the car that you want, and then they'll show you what other people in your area are paying for that car. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can go in and feel confident. Once you register with True Car, you'll also see pricing on the actual inventory, competitive pricing offered to you only by a True Car certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before you go to the dealership, so you can feel confident when you show up. True Car customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with True Car certified dealers. And best of all, True Car users save an average of over $3,000 off of MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. All right, Amanda, so where do we begin this discussion of the psychology of the social game?
It's such a broad topic, and there's so many areas of Survivor that we could cover with this, but I really wanted to focus on three major aspects of the social game. So the first is, you have to work in groups, and groups are such a critical part of the whole structure of the game of Survivor. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what we understand about how people behave in groups. You also have to interpret other people's intentions, their motivations and behavior. So I wanted to talk about what we can learn from psychology about that. And then I wanted to talk about persuasion. So, we could talk about a lot of things, but I wanted to sort of focus on those topics. And then if there's, and then maybe also talk about how gender can play a role in all of those different things. So, yeah. So if you're ready, we can get started talking about, group dynamics and how that, plays out in Survivor.
Is our focus here today to help a future contestant with what's going to happen on Survivor, or are we just trying to better understand why what happens on Survivor happens, or is it both of these things?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really thought that we could look at both of those things. So we can use what we know from psychological theory and research to understand why people behave the way they behave, sometimes even when it's probably not in their best interest. But we can also look at examples about how certain players have used these psychological principles to their advantage and have really turned these features of human behavior into advantages in the game.
So where do we begin?
So, let's talk about groups, because this is really just a fundamental aspect of what Survivor is. When players show up on the beach, they're divided into tribes. So they have to form these groups that both, accomplish, a very specific survival related tasks like building shelter and preparing food. But then we also have groups that work together strategically in alliances, and now we even have voting blocks and trust clusters. So there's lots of group divisions in Survivor. And, one thing that we've learned in psychology is that being in a group really can affect people's behaviors and their thoughts and feelings. So when we're in a group, we tend to favor the people that are in our group. We tend to view people outside of our group as being sort of de-individuated, being more homogeneous, not really having individual personalities. We definitely like to conform to the behaviors in our group. And we see this a lot on Survivor. So if you're in a tribe where a lot of people are praying, somebody like maybe Sophie, who wouldn't always be praying, before every challenge, she's going to conform to the group because she, fitting in is advantageous. Things like yoga and Coach Chi, people want to conform to whatever's going on in the group. So what's really interesting, though, to me about groups is that it takes really surprisingly little to form group identity. So just being assigned a buff on day one can really make you start to identify with a group. And there have been studies that have shown this, that have just kind of randomly assigned people to groups and asked them to do things like, you know, allocate resources either within or without the group. And people already start to show in-group favoritism and this demonizing of the out-group. So it takes very little to develop these group perspectives. And I think that this speaks to why you see pagongings or why you see these tribes remain loyal even after a swap or even when something is not is no longer in the best interest of a player. They might still hold on to their original group identity that they were assigned, even though it was random and arbitrary. And maybe they don't have, you know, particular reason to have a personal bond with an individual. Just being in that group can immediately start to shape their perspective.
I do feel like that this tribal identity that a player gets, it does seem as though that it was more ingrained in these players earlier on, where I'm Tagi, I'm Pagong, and they really sort of embraced that. And of course, the strategy continues to evolve. So do you feel like that the modern day player still has any sort of tribal identity that they sort of like can relate to, or has that just completely gone out the window?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And, you know, I would say that I don't think that it's completely gone out the window. I mean, I think that we've seen this even, you know, we've noted that even in like these returning player seasons, you know, recently in Cambodia, and then, you know, just most recently in Game Changers, you do see a lot of people sticking with their original tribes. And you see these, you know, near pagongings of the out group. But what I do think has changed is the fact that we do have very socially savvy players and strategically savvy players who have now observed how these group dynamics play out in Survivor, and they're able to use those to their advantage.
What about in this upcoming season of Heroes and Hustlers and Healers, or Brains versus Beauty versus Brawn, or Heroes versus Villains? When Survivor sort of forces a label on you and says that everybody in this group, in this tribe, you have this identity, how does that shift in terms of the tribal identity?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I spent a good deal of time thinking about that while I was preparing for this, you know, podcast. And one thing I wanted to talk about is obviously we belong to other social groups, right? Before we enter a tribe or go on Survivor, you know, you could be a Christian or an Alabaman or a football fan. And, you know, all of those things could be part of your social identity. One thing that I think is interesting about these formats that Survivor has imposed on the tribes is that they don't really fit into these categories by which people naturally classify themselves. Like, I don't think that a lot of people go around identifying as, you know, I'm a beauty and all of my friends are beauties. I think it's not a part of their identity that they consider a social part of their identity. Maybe it's considered an individual part of their personality, but not necessarily a social part of their identity. So I almost wonder if those classifiers if people end up wanting to defy those classifiers more than they want to embrace them. And, you know, I think it's an interesting question about whether, you know, having some label imposed on you that might not fit the way that you want to see yourself, does that change how tightly you affiliate with that group? And I think in some cases it could.
Amanda, I this might be opening up a Pandora's box, but I know that, you know, you do follow politics very closely. And I know in terms of, like, there's always been this idea, or at least the last couple of years, of, oh, should they do some sort of like conservative versus liberal season of Survivor? And I do think that that might be a fascinating dynamic just to see that play out, because that in modern day politics, the way that there is like a tribal loyalty of, hey, I'm, you know, going to do always what's best for my political party, and sort of like, you know, we have people who, you know, you follow the news very closely and are sort of, a lot of people are sort of like in their bubble of only getting news sort of like based on these tribal allegiances. I think that that would be a very interesting season of Survivor, where you might not say like, oh, I'm a healer, I'm going to naturally congregate with other healers. But I do feel like that might be an interesting season to see play out. It might be the last season of Survivor.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that political affiliation is a huge social identifier, you know, and you'll hear, you know, people say things about, you know, how, you know, I could never marry somebody from another political party. So I think in terms of social identity, when you talk about a political party affiliation, as opposed to some of these other categories that Survivor has used, that would be a really, really polarizing way to create these tight groups. For that reason, I think that, things could get very ugly. But I mean, if you even look at, like, in millennials versus Gen X, when those identities are not made salient and people are divided in a different way, you have somebody who, like Sunday, who might have very different political and cultural values than like Adam Klein or, you know, Zeke, and they're working together and they form friendships. You know, one of the interesting things about group dynamics is when you create a group that's around one kind of identity, what you're doing is you're making that identity more salient than these other identities. So you can see people working together that in another context, they might not work together and they might never, you know, form an affinity for one another.
Millennials versus Gen X is an interesting one because that people are the, you know, age group that Survivor puts them in. But how many of the people that were on that season necessarily identify as a millennial and that Generation X is bad? I feel like that to me isn't necessarily tribal in terms of dividing people by their age.
Yeah. And I think that felt a little bit artificial. You know, Zeke recently talked on the podcast about just how a lot of people were like, he thought like, oh, I'm a millennial. I never thought about myself that way. And I think a lot of, you know, Gen Xers, which I technically looked it up, you know, and I'm a Gen Xer and I had never been walking around being like, you know, Gen X through and through, you know, I don't think that really activated these identities that are really meaningful to a lot of individuals. But an interesting tribal division that Survivor's now done a few times is men versus women. And obviously, you know, men, like male and female, are really key parts of identities. And I think it's interesting that those, you know, in some seasons we see those identities really take hold, these gender solidarity identities. And in some cases we don't. And that's an interesting way of classifying people, because typically when we create social groups, they tend to be gender mixed, with, you know, exceptions being, you know, athletic participation or some other thing. So I think that depending on the people that you have cast on a season, some people might find those gender divisions really compelling and other people might not really feel like that's part of a group identity that they want to embrace.
That's basically how Survivor puts us into these groups, and people have loyalty at times to the tribe of people that they're put in. But how does that next level relationship of that, okay, I'm within my group, but really the people in my quote unquote tribe / alliance / voting block / trust cluster, how does that relationship start to build?
So when you go from that bigger group into these alliances?
To a smaller group.
Yeah. I think that a big part of that is, you know, what some of these other group identities that we might have, you know, so we talked a little bit about how, you know, you might have also come in and have an identity as a Christian or as a football fan or as an African American. And we've seen people very naturally gravitate to people that they have these commonalities with. But one of the places where I think this gets really interesting strategically is we've seen, you know, really good survivors use the social categories instrumentally to create groups. So when Coach is having prayer circles before every challenge, he's really activating Brendan's identity as a Christian and a few of the other players who, you know, believe that very fervently. And he's making a group where it's about more than just this tribe. It's about who we are fundamentally. And he's using that to cement his core group within his tribe and take an alliance basically all the way to the end of the game. We also saw, you know, Zeke doing that, you know, with Chris and with Brad Culpepper and saying, you know, you guys might not notice this about me right away, but I'm going to talk about football so that you can see that we're part of the same, you know, the same tribe of football fans. And I'm going to try to use that to create a relationship with you. I think those things work more effectively when it's not a relationship with one person, but it creates a little group identity, like a subgroup or an alliance. But we see players make use of those social identities to create subgroups or alliances.
The savvy Survivor player is going out there and trying to just get as much information as they can. And Zeke actually talked about this in his interview of like, pay attention in casting to like the kinds of t-shirts people are wearing, because if you can find those commonalities, that's sort of the building blocks of which these social bonds are formed.
Yeah. I mean, and we see it with like, you know, the Survivor super fans. Well, sometimes, you know, we saw this in Millennials versus Gen X, you know, some of the people who kind of identified themselves as being part of this tribe of super fans, you know, so I think that being really keen to pick up on those cues about what somebody's social identity is, you can use that to create a bond. You know, one other thing I wanted to point out about what, you know, savvy survivors do really well is, you know, they create, I was talking about Coach doing this a little bit with the praying, but, you know, Boston Rob is really like, you know, gave the, you know, the master class in how do you create a strong in-group. And, you know, I rewatched the Merge episode from Redemption Island so I could see exactly how he started to draw the lines between, between his tribe and Zapatera. And, you know, he says in a confessional, it's an us versus them mentality. That's why we have separate shelters and separate eating times. I want them to hate Zapatera. It's us versus them, and we're better than them. And, you know, he really created these super strict norms about what types of interactions were not okay with the other tribe. And like, even things like, you know, not eating together. I mean, it's just saying like, you know, we share nothing with these people. We're not allowing any opportunity for social relationships to form. We want to really think of them as being one homogenous group that we want to have nothing to do with. And it worked.
Trust
amazingly.
Me, we don't want anything to do with them. They're the worst.
Yeah, I mean, and it really worked beautifully with the group of people that he was with. I mean, I wrote down some notes from a conversation where Ralph is trying to talk to Ashley and Natalie and makes them inroads. And he, you know, he says, tell me if I'm on the chop block. And, you know, and Ashley and Natalie are like, oh, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to talk to you and we're not allowed to talk about this. And, you know, he effectively shut down any kind of communication between the two groups. So his alliance was really, you know, it was, they had no other options, and he was able to take that group, you know, all the way to the end.
Yeah, but he did it artfully enough where they didn't ultimately, you know, hold it against him in the final vote. You know, he was able to do it in a way where there was enough respect for what he was able to do, where he sort of set up these rules, but he wasn't sort of the heavy in like telling any of them off. If anything, he like fostered enough ill will between his people and the other side, where it was much more people like Philip who were out there and really being the enforcer of hey, you guys are the bad. We're not talking to you. You guys are the enemy. And he was able to sort of like sit back and not really get a lot of blood on his hands with that.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. And I think, you know, he took this leadership style where he was like mentoring the rest of his tribe. You know, like, I've been through this before, and this is the way that the game is, you know. And at some point, I think, you know, when Natalie's trying to explain why she can't talk to members of the other tribe, she's like, yeah, I know, it's a rough game. And I think what Rob really did was like, he's like, you know, I'm going to show you how, you know, to do this. And it wasn't like he was being an enforcer, but it was like he was giving them the tools to play the game. So it worked really well.
And with those tools, I can also build you a shelter if you need one. But no Zapateras can live in it. It's just for me and my friends. That's it.
Yeah, so there were a couple of other things about group behavior that I wanted to just touch on. So one of those things is this phenomenon of group polarization. So, you know, groups are always more extreme in their opinions than the individuals that make up those groups. So, you know, for example, if you say that Aubrey, JT, and Malcolm are all sort of thinking, you know, hey, Michaela does a little less than her fair share around camp. You know, once those people get together and share that opinion, they're all going to leave having a more extreme opinion of Michaela's laziness. So this is just a phenomenon that we've seen in research, that when you get people together, they take their more moderate views and they always become more extreme. You know, one of these things is like, you know, you can see people get really, really demonized. You know, so one example that stood out to me was how Jonathan Penner gets really demonized by the rest of the Raro group, you know, for being sneaky.
And wrongfully so, I might add.
So at least I got a Jonathan Penner impression. Then this podcast is a win. So but each individual might not have come to the conclusion that Jonathan Penner was doing anything particularly villainous, but once you get a group together, those opinions tend to move to be more extreme.
I think that going back to what we were talking about earlier with Zeke identifying, oh, you like football? I also like football. I think that you can also make those types of bonds with the inverse. And I think that sometimes that can be more of a unifying thing of, oh, you don't like Penner? Like, no. Oh, you tell him what Penner did to you. I really don't like Penner. And I feel like that is often, I think, especially like in workplace environments and certainly amongst friends, and then definitely on Survivor, where people could sort of unite over a common mistrust or dislike or rivalry with a particular person. And I think that that's often the root of like these smaller tribal bonds.
Yeah. I mean, the common enemy is, you know, very powerful. And I think that that's something that, you know, kind of operates in Survivor. Sometimes it happens in a more just kind of naturalistic, organic way. And I do think a lot of players will use that instrumentally, particularly because the common enemy also is somebody that you can, you know, vote out. And once I think a tribe comes together and votes somebody out, the people who voted together leave feeling stronger as a group because they've had that common enemy experience.
And poor Penner. Everybody was so mean to him when they just decided that he was the root of all their evil after the merge.
There's no villain in Monopoly. So, you know, I always like Penner's description of that.
Get off my case, everybody. I just bought Boardwalk.
So there's just one kind of interesting thing I wanted to touch on before we move away from this idea of groups. But there was this theory that was proposed in the 1980s called terror management theory. And the idea behind this is basic. Yeah. It's the idea behind it is that we're all terrified of our own mortality and we have to, you know, take these measures to defend our fragile psyches from fear of death and in these different ways. And, you know, in some of the ways that we do that or by, you know, having a sense that we're part of something greater. And as a consequence, we identify more strongly with groups. So whenever you make somebody think about their mortality, they're going to affiliate more strongly with the groups that they belong to. And, you know, I just thought that, you know, on Survivor, these group identities might be really, really critical because they're literally in a survival circumstance. So they're going to be much more likely to kind of seek that comfort of being part of a group and, you know, maybe bond with these arbitrary tribes or bond with people that they share other social identities with, maybe more so than they would in the comforts of their everyday life.
See, that's interesting to me that you combine it to the survival element, but I almost feel like that there's probably more of a sense of the, you know, metaphorical survival in the game where if I don't stick with this particular group of people, that's my alliance, then my very survival in the game is going to be threatened. And the more that you can make people afraid that they're going to get voted out if they don't stick together with the group, the tighter that group would be.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I actually didn't think about the life in the game, but that could, you know, that could be it. You know, you're terrified of having your torch snuffed. That could activate a lot of the same dynamics.
Like, oh, what's Tony going to do if we let him run wild? Like, oh, he's going to destroy all of us. That we got to stick together and get rid of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I mean, and you do get the sense that people can get really desperate when they feel that their games are on the line or at the end of the road. And I think it can feel really isolating. So we might see this, like, you know, these desperate attempts to kind of mitigate that fear.
Terror management theory.
I know. Isn't that a great name?
This is also good stuff that makes you sound really smart and confessional on Survivor. You talk about, like, I've got something that I like to call terror management theory. That's probably a hashtag. Right?
Yeah. So, well, if a future Survivor gets anything from this podcast, maybe they won't learn how to be a better player, but they could, you know, drop some knowledge in confessional.
Why not? Right?
Yeah. I think it sounds great. Hashtag terror management theory, TMT.
Yeah.
So the next place that I wanted to go is I wanted to talk a little bit about this process of attribution. So one of the things that I think is really critical for a good Survivor player to do is you have to be able to understand what the other player's motivations are for, and you have to be able to interpret their behavior and understand their motivations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a process that in psychology we refer to as, you know, attributions. What do you attribute that behavior to? And, you know, it's important to make the correct attribution because it's going to change the way you behave. So, you know, one example could be if your wife snaps at you in the morning because you forgot to make the coffee, you could wonder, you know, did she yell at me because she hates my guts, or did she yell at me just because she's groggy and needs coffee in the morning?
Could it be both things, Amanda?
I don't know. Do you have any experience with this particular scenario?
Yeah. Yeah, do you have live feeds at my house? Did I Snapchat about this?
Just a pure coincidence, Rob, that I came up with an example like this. So, you know, you want to be able to make the correct attribution so you can adjust your behavior accordingly and you can make decisions about how you're going to behave in the future. Or you can make predictions about how that person might behave in the future. So that's, you know, why attribution is important. And there is a lot of different behaviors that are relevant in Survivor, but probably the most important behavior is voting behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to understand how somebody's going to vote, and you want to understand why somebody voted the way that they did, so you can understand what your prospects are of working with that individual in the future. These attributions can be kind of broadly divided into two types. So you could say that you can attribute something to an internal or personal reason. So if your wife hates you, that would be an internal attribution. She has the hate within her. Or it could be, you could have an external situational attribution. So, oh, somebody being tired, or, you know, the weather being bad, or, you know, something that's not a personal immutable thing would be an external situational attribution.
Amanda, for the most part, though, aren't we sort of helpless to be able to make these attributions? Because aren't we all sort of just locked in our own sort of prism that we can only see the world through our own viewpoint? Isn't it really difficult to be able to tell, you know, what other people are thinking and feeling about certain things?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the take-home messages is that, you know, people are notoriously pretty bad at this, at, like, making attributions. And we tend to make the assumption that people are doing things for in these intrinsic reasons. You know, we tend to downplay how much situational factors might influence their behavior. So, you know, like, you're more inclined to say, like, that person voted against me at the last tribal council, and that's because they don't want to work with me, or they don't like me, or they're my enemy. So we're not particularly good at this. And I think that we do project a lot of our own motivations onto other people. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about that could kind of take us down another road within the realm of psychology. But in general, we just tend to assume that people do things because of these immutable reasons that are core features of their personality, which is not true. People's behavior is really, really influenced by context. So, you know, that's something that I think is, and, you know, you said that aren't we bad at this? And I think that there's some survivors that are, you know, there's some players that are particularly good at this. And I think just being aware of some of the biases that we tend to have can be something that we can then overcome and make better attributions and hopefully have, you know, better outcomes.
And I think Survivor is a exceptionally difficult place to try to test this, because in real life that we don't have as many external factors that we can attribute things to. And, you know, we actually have a lot in our everyday lives, I think, between, you know, stress and traffic and all sorts of other factors. But on Survivor, I mean, I feel like that's really multiplied by the inclement weather and the lack of food and resources and the overall stress from the game and missing family. I think it's really hard to be able to decipher what's an external motivator and what's an internal motivator.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, it is tricky in Survivor. I mean, one of the advantages, I think, though, you know, one of the ways that Survivor kind of boils things down and becomes like a little bit of a microcosm is we sort of make the assumption that the players are kind of motivated to perform well in the game, you know, right? So whereas like in everyday life, like you could have motivations to do well at work, or you could have motivations to, you know, impress certain people in your friendship group, you know, there's a and obviously I think those things are also motivating survivors, but they're also kind of focused on the same game state outcome. So we can try to, we kind of simplify things in that regard, but it is complicated, and especially because we don't have, you know, these players, especially in a new player season, don't have a lot of context on, you know, what these individuals have behaved like in the past by which they can, you know, make these attributions. But I do think that the really good survivors, what they do have in common in this regard is they don't immediately go to the assumption that other players' behaviors are immutable. They go into every interaction thinking, let's see if I can change this context and make this player who might not be inclined to work with me, work with me. And I did pull some examples, Rob, and you are one of them.
Oh, boy.
Oh, and I think that you did a really good job with this.
Oh.
When, you know, when Jenna and Heidi were, you know, after the Alex blind side, you know, they gave you every reason to think that they, you know, hated your guts and would never work with you again. But instead of, you know, sort of taking that at face value, you said, you know, well, you know, maybe as the numbers shift and their situation changes and they're in the minority, I can put a coalition together to vote out Christy at this next tribal council. So, you know, instead of taking them as being these, you know, as being fixed in a certain state, you didn't close that door. You thought that there might still be ways for you guys to work together.
Yeah. Well, probably a little bit to my detriment. I think too much. I thought that they were going to be motivated by trying to win the game. But I kind of felt like that more so than winning the game. I felt like that they were really motivated that they wanted to get Christy out of the game. So I felt like that was a win-win for both of us, where I felt like that this was going to help get me through that obstacle. And I felt like that they were just, you know, both, you know, they were excited to stay in the game together and then also get Christy out of the way. They were very, I think, both fixated on getting further than Christy in the game because they felt like that they had done more than her. So I felt like that was a really good solution to a problem at that point.
Well, then you did a really good job interpreting their motivation. So that gets you on the list of great Survivor players, according to social psychology.
Well, yeah. That'll get you so far.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of things only getting you so far, you know, I was really interested in the Aubrey podcast recently. And, you know, she said this, and I think Zeke and Sari all said this at some point in their exit interviews or podcasts with you, when you asked, like, you know, who did you want to work with or who were you willing to work with? And I think all three of them were like, I would have worked with anybody. And I think that's no mistake that Aubrey was able to get to the final five despite losing all of her allies. I think that she didn't let those doors close and was, you know, she didn't let her original tribal identity or the way people had voted against her in the past close her off to the possibility that, you know, if the situation changed, she could maybe get together a working coalition.
Is there a point of diminishing returns with this? Because I do feel like that there's a fine line between willing to work with anybody and desperation, which, you know, as a wise man once said, is a stinky cologne.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that I don't know if we could make a judgment in Aubrey's case about, you know, I think that the key difference between, you know, this kind of flexibility and desperation is, you know, you don't want to make people emotionally uncomfortable when you approach them. You know, you don't want to make them feel like, oh gosh, this person is like really, you know, it's such a bummer to talk to them. They seem so desperate. I think if you can approach people in a way where you're not kind of putting any emotional baggage on them, but, you know, you're expressing a willingness to work with them, I think that it probably can work to your advantage. In some cases, I think, you know, Brad was not going to see it as in his best interest to work with Aubrey instead of somebody else, even though he probably would have had a better chance against Aubrey than Sarah. You know, he just wasn't going to see it that way. So I don't know if there was anything she could have done.
Yeah, it's a fine line to figure out exactly. You want to give people the impression that you're there to work with them, but not necessarily that you are really dire. Like, hey, I need you.
Yeah, you don't want to be needy. It's not a good look.
Not a good look.
And, you know, and another thing about this influence of situations, I think that some of, you know, you also see really good players trying to change the context or change the situation so that they can have more control over other players' behaviors. And, you know, there are, you know, a handful of these situations where voting out a key person in an alliance can, you know, kind of open things up and allow there to be more room for, you know, one player to work. You know, we see how Spencer votes out Steven so that he can take that place as Jeremy's number two. So I think that being tuned into all the contextual factors that you can either highlight or that you can manipulate, you know, you can get players to work with you that might have otherwise not been working with you.
And the only way to really get this information is just to keep a constant line of communication open, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, that that's going to be important. It's either whether you're, you know, either whether it's through a constant line of communication or always observing, you know, each player. And I think that some of the players that get themselves stuck in situations where they don't have a lot of options is, you know, they were really stuck. I mean, this is very much akin to David Bloomberg's be flexible rule is, you know, if you're stuck thinking, oh, these are my five to the end, and this is the group that I'm working with, and you haven't opened up any of those other relationships, and you haven't even really been paying attention to what those other players are doing, then you're just not going to have those options and you're not going to be able to manipulate those contexts so that it works in your advantage.
Yeah, something that Sarah was able to do very well in the Game Changers.
Absolutely.
Amanda, before we get to the next part of this, let me just take a quick word and thank one of our other sponsors. And those are the people over at Hulu. And you talk about trying to stay flexible, that there's so many different things you've been watching on Hulu. Original series like The Handmaid's Tale, Harlots, and Casual, in addition to full seasons of Fargo, Blackish, Empire, Fear the Walking Dead, Nashville, exclusively on Hulu. But guess what? Hulu's got a brand new look and experience. They're changing it up, and now they're adding live TV to Hulu. Get ready to transform the way you experience TV. Hulu with Live starts at $39.99 a month, which includes the limited commercial Hulu streaming plan, and it includes 50-plus live and on-demand channels. You'll be watching sports, including ESPN, FS1, including regional sports, news, and other can't-miss events. And you could be recording live TV with the cloud DVR. 50 hours of storage included with an option to upgrade up to 200 hours available on iOS, Android, new Apple TV, Xbox One, Chromecast, with more devices coming soon. So enjoy all your TV in one place with the brand new Hulu experience. Go to Hulu.com to start your free trial today. All right, Amanda, what else about the psychology of the social game?
So I want to talk about something that I think is, you know, a really, really important aspect of good survivor play, and that is persuasion. So it's really important for you to be able to persuade other people to behave in your best interest, to vote a certain way, to work with you.
And not vote you out.
And not vote you out. Critically not vote you out. You can't win if you get voted out. Unless it's a hot takeoff and you're Lil and you get to be a pretty good winner of Survivor. So there's basically, I mean, and this is something that, you know, and maybe this is true of a lot of these things, but, you know, all of us savvy observers of human behavior, even if we've never studied psychology, have probably come to some of the conclusions that I'm talking about today, you know, on your own. But, you know, one thing that we've talked about on the podcast quite a bit is, you know, whether you're making the logical argument or the emotional argument. And, you know, in psychology, we've talked about this as, you know, these two routes to persuasion. So the central route is this logical route where you're going to give a careful, thoughtful consideration. You're going to present to the person this careful, thoughtful case for, you know, what you would like them to do in support of a position. And this central route of persuasion tends to be very effective, but it requires a high level of thought and investment from the person that you are trying to persuade. So it's, you know, it's cognitively demanding to process an argument. You have to be really motivated. You have to really care about the case that's being presented to you. So while it can be effective, it has this downside in that it can be a little more of an intensive process for the person that you're trying to persuade.
It's hard to cold call, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's something that it takes time, and the person you're presenting this to has to really care enough to like listen to everything that you're saying and weigh it carefully.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The alternative is this peripheral route to persuasion, and that's this more emotional appeal. And it tends to, you know, people will make really simple inferences about the merits of the position, and they might be based on these somewhat arbitrary cues. Like if they think the person making this case is, you know, attractive, they're going to like it more. So it could be more influenced by superficial cues. Opinions that people form that way are not as enduring and might not be as influential as those logical arguments that they absorb, but they make these opinions really quickly and they can affect their behavior.
Do you have some examples that are sort of one versus the other?
Yeah, yeah, I do. So you see some places where survivors have made mistakes in that they've made an assumption that one kind of argument is going to be effective. So you see like Shireen and Spencer in Cambodia, they came to great consensus among one another because they were both these highly invested survivor strategists who are very logically minded, but they couldn't really build a larger coalition. You have to really be able to put yourself in the mind of who you're trying to persuade and say, is this somebody who is going to invest enough in this conversation for a logical appeal to be effective? Or is this somebody that I'm going to make get a lot more traction if I use a more emotional appeal?
Would you say that one works better at different stages of the game? So when you're talking about Spencer and Shireen in Cambodia, that was in the opening stages of the game. They hadn't really built bonds yet with the other players, and they were trying to make pitches based more on logic and strategy. Whereas, would an emotional pitch work better in the early part of the game, and then the strategic pitch would work better later in the game as you get closer to the money?
Yeah, I think that that's a really great point. You know, particularly because people might not feel like, you know, oh, you know, it's as long as it's not me, I don't care who the first one out is. But once the numbers get down and people see a path to the end, their investment in what the decision that they make is going to be much higher. So I think that gauging that for the right point in the game is also really important. You know, another thing that this made me think of, you know, is, you know, I know that Steven has talked in the podcast before about like how people just kind of get fatigued with the whole idea of working out these vote splits at some point because it's complicated. It takes a lot of thought. It's math. People are tired and hungry and they don't want to do it anymore. And so you can see that, you know, at different points in the game, people, you know, they just might not have the same, you know, level of enthusiasm for working through these different, you know, numerical machinations. And, you know, you're just going to have to go with what the group is going to be more prepared for in that case and not try to push these, you know, really logical arguments about voting one way or another. We also see, however, sometimes players make an assumption that an emotional appeal is going to work, but they're talking to a player, a logical, highly motivated player, and that kind of pitch falls flat. So I think of Terry, you know, going to Suri in Panama and saying, you know, hey, you can just relax and not think about the vote for a few weeks. And, you know, that was an argument that was never going to resonate with Suri because she wanted to, you know, be a strategist and be involved in orchestrating the vote. This idea of just sitting back and relaxing, you know, wasn't going to appeal to her.
So let me ask you, is this based more on circumstance or based more on the player? So, for instance, you have, you know, Terry and Suri. Are there instances when Terry would, a strategic argument would work better with him and instances when an emotional argument would work better with Suri?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's both. I think that there are some players who are going to be more inclined just because of what the game means to them and the way that they approach the game. I think there's some players that are always going to be inclined to the logical argument or the emotional argument. But I also think that, like, knowing that there are certain times when we're going to be, you know, cognitively and emotionally depleted, there's probably some points in during any game at which a player is going to gravitate to an emotional argument because, you know, maybe it was just the loved one's visit and you had this really overwhelming emotional experience and you just sort of feel spent and you don't want to sit down and, you know, work through all of these different strategic cases. Or, you know, maybe it's, you know, you haven't eaten in several days, or it's a particularly tough time in terms of the weather. So I think it's both being really sensitive to context and also being really sensitive to the type of person that you're trying to make a case to.
Are there any tells of somebody who is going to be more compelled by a strategic argument versus somebody who's going to be more compelled by an emotional argument?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that kind of, like, roughly speaking, like, anybody who would fall into this super or super duper fan category, you could, you know, maybe make the assumption that they're going to be the more strategically minded type. You know, I think that there might be some, like, people who seem to be really, you know, invested in winning, you know, the type of person who says, you know, that I'm here for the experience, or, you know, I just want to have a good time. So somebody like, you know, a Taylor from Millennials versus Gen X, you know, I don't think that he's going to be somebody who's going to be particularly interested in the logical arguments. You'll probably get further with the emotional appeal to Taylor. You know, it's not always going to be a one-to-one where it's easy to tell, but I do think that there are probably some good indicators that, you know, somebody is maybe there to have fun and wants to go as far as possible, but, you know, maybe not as invested in winning, and somebody, you know, who's really, really motivated to make the most of the game.
So it would be probably a good idea for someone who was strategically motivated to sort of signal to the other players at the start of the game that they were really emotionally motivated. And I'm not sure necessarily what the best way to do that would be, but I think that that really is scary. You know, all these people that we're talking about are that are strategically minded. Those are all the people that I feel like other players are saying, oh, got to get rid of this person, got to get rid of this person, got to worry about this person. Whereas somebody who is coming across as emotionally motivated is not seen as a threat. So if you can mask that, I think that's probably something that Sarah did well, something that Jeremy did well. I think that that is a really powerful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, if you have that gear to turn it on at the end when, you know, your cases might be more effective in, like, the smaller group at the end game, then I think that, you know, that that's probably, like, the best way to go. But I think that coming out really hard, like the way that, you know, we were talking about Shireen and Spencer at the beginning of Cambodia, that's probably not the right time for those arguments. It might turn off your tribe, and you know, it could put a target on you pretty early on.
I do think that the people that get the, oh, I just want to make it to the family visit, I think that that's a thing. I feel like that more often than not, the survivors kind of, like, keep that as a factor where if you just, oh, I just want to make it to the family visit, they say, okay, well, then we could get rid of this person and then they'll be happy to go to the jury if they can just make it to the family visit. That's a good line that survivors use.
Yeah, I've heard that come up on podcasts recently, and I think it's totally brilliant, because if people assume that you have a motivation that's different from the motivation to win, then, you know, then they're not going to be threatened carrying you along.
It's like, oh, Brad, he's not trying to win. He just wants to make it to the family visit. And then you look up and he's in the final three because he won all the immunity challenges.
Mm-hmm. So another aspect of persuasion that I think is really, really interesting that I want to spend some time talking about is this idea of cognitive dissonance. So, you know, we become very uncomfortable when our beliefs, feelings, and behaviors don't all line up. So a good example of cognitive dissonance kind of operating in the everyday world is, you know, let's say somebody is a smoker, but they believe that, you know, smoking is bad for your health and, you know, could eventually, you know, make you sick and kill you. So that's a kind of uncomfortable behavior and, you know, set of beliefs to hold. So what people will do is, you know, they'll try to make things line up. So either you'll quit smoking so you no longer have this conflict, or maybe you'll just change your thoughts and beliefs so that they're not as in conflict with your behavior. So maybe you'll say, well, like, yeah, smoking's not great for you, but a lot of things are bad for you and you only live once and, you know, carpe diem. So, mm-hmm. you know, people have to find some way to justify, you know, how these things line up, or else, you know, they're kind of in this unstable state where something's going to have to change. So, you know, I think the way that this operates in Survivor is you have to vote somebody out, and that behavior is going to be uncomfortable for you if, you know, you think that either you have a cognition that says, you know, oh, this person's really important for my game, or probably more likely you have a feeling that is, you know, I have a friendship to this person and I think of myself as a loyal person. So, you know, when somebody's experiencing this dissonance, then as a savvy player, you have to sort of understand where everybody in your group is in terms of their thoughts and their feelings in order for their behavior to then be predictable.
Yeah, this is an interesting idea, especially with these survivors when you have to betray someone who's an ally. I think that you'll often hear them say, like, oh, well, I saw them talking to a certain person, and to me, that was the betrayal. So I was only going after them because they broke my bond with them. Or they sort of come up with some other way to demonize a person who was an ally, just to sort of wrap their head around, no, I had the moral high ground to do what I did to that person because of what they did first.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the kind of thing that we see all the time, you know, when somebody's forced to turn on or decides to turn on a former ally, they have to come up with either an intellectual justification for that or an emotional justification for that. So, you know, like, you were going to betray me, or I saw you do this, or, you know, I decided that, you know, this is the kind of game that I'm playing. So they have to come up with something that, you know, makes that behavior okay. You know, I think that this gets really interesting, though, is when, you know, a good survivor player will manipulate the dissonance in somebody else. So, for example, one thing that's important is, you know, you have to recognize, like, let's say you're counting on a key ally. So if you're Brad Culpepper and you want Ty to vote out Caleb, you have to recognize that that's going to cause a conflict for him, that, you know, he was at Caleb's wedding and he considers Caleb a friend. So, you know, what Brad did was he gave Ty the shift, like, he gave Ty the justification so that he could feel at ease with that decision. So he says, you know, you're here for you, you're not here for anybody else. And he kind of gives Ty this new way of thinking about it so that he's able to go through with voting out Caleb without having to feel like he's a bad friend or he did something disloyal.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you'll be a threat if he stays in the game. So this is going to be ultimately a bad thing for you if you don't make this move and you're finally being able to sort of like take this, the bull by the horns, Ty. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and if you contrast that with, like, you know, Jason and Scott and Ko Rong, who, you know, Ty's saying, I really like Aubrey. And they're like, OK, well, we'll vote her out. You know, they didn't give Ty, like, it's not as though they couldn't have convinced Ty to vote Aubrey out at that spot, but they didn't do anything to help him resolve that tension. So he ends up aligning with Aubrey, and, you know, that doesn't work out for Jason and Scott.
I do think that Ty is prone to the emotional argument more so than the strategic one, right?
I would say so. I would say so. And I think that, you know, that one of the things we've gotten to see across a couple seasons now is that, you know, some players, I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever managed Ty with 100% effectiveness, mm-hmm. but some players are able to recognize that and, you know, manage that and get Ty to work with them, you know, much better than others. And I think it has to do with being really attuned to, you know, well, what is he thinking and what is he feeling and where are his conflicts going to come from?
Yeah, that being said, I do think that the Brad argument to Ty about Caleb was a strategic one, which is interesting to see Brad, who we think of as somebody who would be more motivated by the emotional argument, use yeah. the strategic argument on Ty, who we think would also be more motivated by the emotional argument.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason I brought it up here was because I think it worked because it allowed Ty to think like, I do love Caleb. I am loyal to him. I am his friend, but it gave him a different way, a cognitive frame. Like, but this game is about me and this game is about, you know, me getting further. So, you know, he didn't have to demonize Caleb. He didn't have to think that Caleb was a bad guy or that his friendship wasn't important. It just gave him a different way to think about that.
And the other interesting part of this is that, you know, it's like, what, day nine? So it's not really a part of the game where the players are too taxed physically or emotionally yet at this point. So it might just be where there's more clarity of thinking at this early stage in the game. Whereas later on in the game, when your sort of mind has been weakened and your body is deteriorated because of the game, it might be easier to lean onto the emotional aspects of an argument, which is sort of the inverse of what we said, where we thought maybe players might be more motivated by the strategic argument late in the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be a balance, right? Because it's going to be you're closer and you want it more, but you've also been depleted to this point where you're probably not, you know, at your sharpest. But I think that makes a lot of sense.
I do think that it's easier to see the light at the end of the tunnel, whereas it's harder, I think, on the day nine or, you know, early stages of the game when we're talking about Shireen and Spencer trying to make an argument of like, no, look at the chessboard, look five yeah. moves ahead. I do think that that's harder to sell as opposed to, no, it's like, hey, just make this one vote and you'll be in the final three. I do think that that can be effective as well as you get towards the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I wanted to say about cognitive dissonance is I think a really interesting way that players can use this is they can create dissonance in other players that will make them change their behavior. So the example that I have for this is, you know, how Tony convinced Wu to vote out Cass at Final Three in Cagayan. And Wu was going to be, would have been able to, you know, vote out Tony, go to the end with Cass and probably increase his odds greatly of winning that season. But, you know, Tony really put Wu in a position where he was made to see how that choice would have conflicted with his core values, like so his kung fu values and how he'd play this game. And he really activated in Wu this strong feeling that he's a loyal person and that's who he is in his real life. And that's the kind of game he played in Survivor. So if he voted out Cass, that would be in conflict with all of these things that are important to Wu. And I think that the way that Tony played that was actually, you know, really instrumental in changing Wu's vote and probably getting him to, you know, vote against what he had already figured out was in his best interest.
Wu, trust me, that I've got your best interests at hand. I'm going to create some dissonance.
I'm sure that's exactly what Tony was thinking. I'm going to create some dissonance.
It's in his bag of tricks.
It's in his bag of tricks. Cognitive dissonance was in his bag of tricks.
Yeah. Cognitive dissonance are us. That's the new Tony and Sarah alliance.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's also Tony and Sarah, you know, being part of Cops Are Us and having all of this experience in policing, you know, means that they have this experience talking to people and, you know, getting confessions out of criminals. Or, you know, I think that it's not a coincidence that both of them were able to, you know, really, really navigate some of this social stuff in a really effective way.
But just to go back to the original Cops Are Us, where you had Sarah coming to Tony and saying, hey, are you a cop? She's trying to create a tribal bond of that we're both part of this same tribe of police officers. She's trying to, you know, build a coalition off of that, that we have similar values and we're similar people because we're both police officers. And that was something that was important to Sarah. But for Tony, he wasn't thinking along those same lines. And that was like the beginning of the conflict between the two of them.
Yeah. And in Tony's case, it was actually an aspect of his identity that he wanted to hide and he wanted to be deceptive about. So, you know, she just made the wrong call. He wasn't the right cop to make that move to because, you know, he was coming in and trying to disguise that aspect of his identity. And, you know, and I think that Sarah came back and she, you know, decided this is not going to be the part of my identity that I'm most strongly trying to portray. I'm going to, you know, act like a criminal this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wanted to move on to just like a couple more points in terms of persuasion. There's this idea of scarcity. So people tend to want things that aren't readily available, and it might be easier to persuade somebody to do something that seems risky and that will lead to a rare consequence than something that is, you know, safe and leads to a more common consequence. So I think that this is really like one of the explanations for this big moves era of Survivor and the attraction of big moves. And, you know, you see Sarah's quote from this season about how, you know, I could be in this alliance and we could go to the end, but that's stupid. That's boring. I don't like it.
That's stupid. That's boring. I don't like it.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think this really sums up this idea that people are much more attracted to things that are flashy and seem rare than they are to things that might be, you know, a little bit more predictable and safe. So, you know, the way you can use this persuasively is if you can pitch somebody something that puts them at the center of a big move, as opposed to something that's just, you know, you'll be one of our five, the extent to which you can make an appeal that is going to seem like this is going to be a big flashy thing for you, you might be a little bit more effective.
So, okay, this is interesting. So the idea of big moves, you're chalking that up to that there is a scarcity of big moves in any given Survivor season. And so the players covet both the big moves and sort of the accolades that you get from Jeff Probst for making the big moves. So you can sell people on that.
Yeah. So it's the idea. I mean, at the end of a season, maybe there's two or maybe three things that everybody's talking about as like this was such a big move. And a lot of players might want to be that person who's associated with that. So, you know, I think that that's something that could be used effectively to pitch to people. I mean, just think about like, you know, if you're selling somebody on being one of the five that goes to the end and we're the alliance that sticks together, they might be susceptible to, you know, some other pitch that's a little bit flashier, a little bit more interesting because it's going to make them part of something special.
So this is turning into a whole different fascinating conversation because I want to talk to you about the deflation of big moves in the Survivor economy because as you said, well, maybe there's only two or three big moves that everybody is talking about, but as there has been an influx of big moves, almost as if the Survivor Treasury is minting more big moves every single week, do you feel like that has depressed the impact of the scarcity of big moves?
Well, it's probably had two effects. So yeah, they're less rare and therefore, you know, less valuable in these economic terms. But I think that they're also seen as maybe less risky. People are more familiar with them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's probably operating on these sort of two competing psychological principles. You know, one, you might be a little risk averse, but on the other hand, you really want this big flashy thing.
And everybody's doing it.
You know, I mean, I think so we are seeing more big moves. And I don't think that big moves always translate to wins, you know, by any means. But I think that, you know, some players, you might be able to really entice them to flip alliances or, you know, do this will be your big move. You know, I think that Albert convincing Brandon Hans to give away his immunity necklace, sometimes it's easier to make the big sell than it is to make the small sell. And I think that this kind of notion of scarcity could be one of the reasons that explains that.
Well, in terms of the scarcity of big moves and sort of like ownership of the big moves, I do think that there is some interesting psychological principles at work, because I do think that Survivor has done an effective job of indoctrinating its contestants with the mindset of, hey, even if you lose, so what? As long as you go down swinging, the adventure was worth it. Whereas the worst thing that you can be on Survivor in 2017 is a person who was just there, who did nothing, who got no airtime. I mean, and if you take a look back at, you know, this past season, and there's been, I don't want to pick on Troyzan, but it's almost like, well, you just got, you got to the end, but did you make any big moves? Did you get a lot of airtime? And it's almost like that, and we've had a lot of different players that do that, where it used to be, you know, hey, I made it 39 days, and, you know, that was, you know, a great feat. It's almost like the player who, yes, I went out early, but I was like, I really went for it. I provided great moments. I think that person ends up being celebrated. And I think that that's something interesting in terms of like how players look at the game.
Yeah, no, and this also gets at the, you know, at the fact that, you know, Survivor isn't just a game, it's also a television show. And, you know, people have motivation to get airtime. So this is like another competing motivation that could be aligned with winning the game, but it could also be misaligned with winning the game. So as a savvy player who maybe only cares about winning the game and doesn't care if you have a Sprodlin-esque edit or a, you know, or a Sophie Clark type of edit, maybe you can manipulate the idea that somebody like, you know, Coach might really love the airtime, or somebody else that you're playing with might have a different motivation. And, you know, particularly when, you know, big moves can backfire, you know, I think that sometimes letting somebody else take a big move, or, you know, using that as a way to entice somebody to flip, you know, could be an effective form of persuasion.
But I almost feel like having the big move that backfires, there is a certain psychology of the Survivor player that is better than not have taken the shot at the big move at all.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and I think that there's, you know, there's a case to be made for that. And, you know, Jeff Probst has made the case that, you know, statistically on day one, you're not likely to win. So when you're at the beginning of the game, you know, you don't have a lot to lose in being a flashy player. I think as you get to the finish line, if you see the end in sight, that might be a time to kind of tighten up and take a safer path to the end. But, you know, there's definitely something to that. And, you know, Troyzan wasn't particularly happy with the edit that he got.
Even the title Game Changers, I think, speaks to that of these are the people who did change the course of the action. And there is some currency in that of being a person who is willing to make a move. It doesn't matter if it worked or not, but they were willing to attempt to make one of those scarce decisions that changed the outcome of a game.
It definitely makes you stand out as a player. And I think that that's what this notion of scarcity is, that, you know, people are bored with what is more commonplace. And we're all wired to be attracted to something that is out of the norm and that seems daring in some ways. And it might be a particularly good time in the timeline of Survivor to make these cases about big moves, because, you know, you can say things like, you know, you don't want to get to the end and, you know, not have gotten any airtime. And I think the players are much, much more savvy about how Survivor is a television show and, you know, how they can parlay that into social media and other things. So I think that it's a good tack to take. So there's just a couple more things that I wanted to talk about today. Those were really the major areas that I wanted to talk about. But I also wanted to bring up a couple of things that I think affect certain players that we might not be as tuned into. I wanted to talk about players who have some kind of communication barrier and point out, you know, what we know from psychological research about how that affects relationship forming and bonding. So there's been research that shows that when communication difficulties are introduced into a social interaction, and they usually do this by like setting up a video chat and introducing an artificial delay. And I'm sure that you and, you know, all of your time of using audiovisual communication and being on phone calls mm-hmm. have had awkward connections. And when you introduce those delays, people end up leaving those interactions having a lot of anxiety and having more negative feelings about their conversation partner. And it turns out that those negative feelings are even more pronounced when the conversation partner was from a different ethnic or racial group than that mm-hmm. individual. So I think that this is really interesting when you look at Ty playing the game, who obviously has, you know, some level of a communicative disadvantage because he's a non-native English speaker. And, you know, he's having these conversations with players on the beach, and some of them might be leaving feeling kind of, you know, I didn't really understand him, and they might be disinclined to work with him. And, you know, I think that Sandra in the exit press said somewhere that she couldn't understand what Ty was saying, so she was disinclined to work with him. And this isn't something that reflects any kind of malice in the other players, but it's just a reality of something that Ty has to deal with because, you know, his trouble communicating is going to cause these anxious and negative feelings in other people and undoubtedly also in himself because he's having trouble getting his thoughts across.
What can somebody do about this in terms of, I guess, for a player like Ty himself or for the other players that are in the game?
So, I mean, I think it depends on if you're another player in the game and, you know, you want to work with Ty. I think that, you know, being aware of that, you can probably have some control over the extent to which that influences your feelings about him. So, you know, with a lot of these kind of subconscious biases, there's evidence that shows that when individuals become aware of their biases, they're able to correct them and make some grounds. But, you know, you could also be really cynical and say, you know, this is something that I could use to my advantage if I want to eliminate Ty from the game. So, you know, sometimes what is going to be best gameplay is maybe not what is, you know, pro-social and the most politically correct thing to do, but people could certainly use that to their advantage if they wanted to demonize a player like Ty. But I do think that it's something that, you know, and Ty, I think, could even maybe, you know, to mitigate some of those negative effects, you know, he could try to put people more at ease by, you know, saying like, you know, I know that I'm really difficult to understand, maybe not getting into lengthy conversations that are going to cause misunderstandings. So there might be some things that he could do to make other people more comfortable, which unfortunately puts a burden on him. But it's just a tricky thing that I think that, you know, people could be aware of because these communication difficulties can make a big impact. And I also thought of, you know, some of the contestants who have been hearing impaired in the past, and, you know, and Abby Maria might also be somebody in this context, but even like these very, very subtle communication barriers can make it harder to work with somebody and might put them at a little bit of a social disadvantage.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point.
To move on, I wanted to talk a little bit about like this idea of gender and leadership and how the gender of a player might influence what kind of leadership styles will be effective for them, and also how the gender of a player is going to influence how other players might see them in the game.
Okay.
So there's some, you know, gender stereotypes that we have, like men are generally viewed as more competitive, assertive, independent, and achievement oriented. And we tend to see women as more warm and sociable, interdependent, and relationship oriented. And, you know, to an extent, we're all motivated to embrace these stereotypes because they're so pervasive. And, you know, it also kind of helps us explain the reasons why the world is the way that it is. We do know that in general, you know, from a lot of studies that have been done over 50 years now, that both men and women in general are more accepting of male leaders. And, you know, one of those reasons is women are associated with these more social communal qualities. And that includes things like being affectionate, being helpful, friendly, and kind. But men are associated with these more agentic qualities, so like that have to do with assertion and control. when women actually embrace those qualities that are considered more stereotypically male, people, both men and women, tend to judge them more harshly. So women who take on kind of ambitious, dominant, self-confident roles can actually be judged negatively by both men and women. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it sort of suggests what type of ways of interacting will be more effective for male or female players. And while it might be effective for somebody like Boston Rob to be the leader of his alliance and to dictate plans and to make rules, that kind of style might not be received as well if it comes from a woman. And I think if you look at some of the female winners, not all of our female winners, but some of the female winners that are kind of considered the best, the most highly regarded female winners, you can see that they really had a lot of these communal, socially oriented qualities, and that their form of leadership was a little bit more about gaining trust and confidence in the other players, being somebody who was well-liked and well-regarded, rather than, you know, being somebody who was seen as like a strategic mastermind who was making decisions and leading an alliance in a real authoritative way.
Is the takeaway that it's harder for a woman to win Survivor because there is a narrower path for her to get to the end and get the jury votes, whereas there are a number of different ways a male Survivor player could take on the game?
You know, I don't even want to say that it's harder. I think it's harder for a woman who plays a certain type of game to win Survivor. So I think it's probably harder for a woman who is very strategically oriented and wants to be a real leader of an alliance. I mean, that's a hard way to win a game anyway, you know, to win as the out front leader. But, you know, women, I think, are not going to be as highly regarded if they are touting their strategic. So if you get to a final tribal council and you're touting your strategic moves and how much control you had during the game, that might be an argument that is less well received. You know, just based on, you know, what we know from how people generally behave in research studies. But if you get to the end as a woman and you make an argument about how you had these social relationships, you always knew what was going on because you had gone out of your way to make bonds with everybody. I think if you highlight those things to a jury, that might be a more successful strategy for a woman. I don't know if that might not be as successful a strategy for a man, for example. Like if you have a man who is two men sitting next to each other and one of them is making the case that they led, that they had a really dominant strategic game and the other one is saying, I had relationships, the jury might say like, well, we like the manlier game better. So I don't know if it's harder for women to win Survivor, but I do think that it's harder for a certain type of game, and the type of game that maybe the super fans are a little bit more into. It might be harder for that type of woman to win Survivor.
So it's just something that a female Survivor contestant might need to be more mindful of.
Yeah, and it's probably something that, you know, depends on, you know, you have to know your jury. I mean, a lot of these are rules about people in general, but they're not rules about every individual, you know. So, but it's something that you should be mindful of. And I think in, you know, the debate of, you know, Aubrey versus Michelle, you know, you can see that, you know, Michelle maybe was more in that kind of communal leadership type, and Aubrey was a little bit more in that agentic leadership type. And, you know, that was a jury for very much that preferred, you know, Michelle's game. And maybe coming from a man, Aubrey's game might have been regarded differently, maybe not. But Michelle, I think, leaned into that in ways that, you know, she definitely deserves credit for. So it's definitely something that I think if you're a good Survivor player, you need to sort of be aware of, you know, how people are going to be motivated to see you, what kind of things are going to go over well, and what kind of things, you know, might be things that you'll be judged harshly for if you get to the end. And unfortunately, you know, gender influences that.
When you talk about agentic leadership style, that I'm not familiar with that, is that having an agenda?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, so sorry to use a little jargon, but those are really qualities that convey control. So if you're seen as somebody who's in control, then you're like the main agent of action for that group. So, you know, things like being dominant, being self-confident, and being individualistic, those are seen as agentic qualities. So things that are associated with assertion and control.
Okay. I feel like that's a big part of my winner rankings. Are you saying that my evolution strategy winner rankings are skewed more heavily towards men?
You know, they probably are, because that is a big part of your winner rankings, Rob. But I think it speaks to, like, you know, this is what the super fans like. I think it's very hard for, I mean, and I don't know, I don't want to dissect your winner rankings and count how many women are represented among them. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if women are unrepresented, just because it's a harder game for a woman to win. And I don't think that it's that women aren't capable of that game or can't play that game. But I think that people like Kim Spradlin and, you know, Parvati are, you know, very smart and very socially savvy, and they know the way that other people want to see them. And, you know, I think that that means that they're not always going to be the person who's really out front, you know, calling shots and doing that in a really visible way. You know, interestingly, earlier in the episode, I mentioned that I watched the Merge episode of Redemption Island to see, you know, how Rob, you know, gathered his troops together. And I also watched the Merge episode of One World to watch how Kim did it, because there are two, you know, of the top winners in my mind. And Kim was really like nowhere to be seen in the Merge episode of One World. And she was really like sitting back, and you could see she was observing things and she was letting other people make mistakes. But it was just a very different style, and it worked for her. And I think that she executed it beautifully. But it really shows how the best female game might look different than the best male game.
Yeah. And I'm also sure that at some point baked into that is that Kim came from a men versus women season. So I think that's probably also got to be part of this equation. And I'm not smart enough to figure out exactly where that is and where her agency comes from in that particular season. But certainly a lot to chew on.
So that kind of gets me to the end of my notes.
Okay. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for walking us through this. I mean, is there any sort of like big takeaway that you had after going through all of this and doing all this research? A unifying theory?
The unifying theory. I think that the big takeaway for me, I mean, is that the best Survivor players are, you know, extremely self-aware and extremely socially aware. And you have to be self-aware enough to overcome your own biases that we're all subject to. You know, we all might gravitate towards certain things because they're comfortable, but you also have to be socially aware enough to identify other people's biases and use those to your advantage. So, you know, I think that a lot of the great Survivor players have really good intuitive senses of psychology. But, you know, for those of us who don't, luckily, there's hundreds of years of research on this stuff, so we can all catch up.
Yeah. And I think it's a hard thing to fake for a Survivor player. I think you have to be genuinely interested in people. And I think you have to be not necessarily interested in strategy, interested in numbers, but you really have to get to know and study these other bizarre people that they've found. Everybody is different, but they're all sort of like enough of an extrovert that they all want to be on a TV show and playing Survivor, and just get to know and learn as much as you can about these players. And if you already have like a predisposition to being interested in that sort of thing, I think it makes your job a lot easier on Survivor.
Absolutely. I mean, because all of the strategy has to flow through social behavior. So no matter how much you're, you know, studying the numbers and the different scenarios, you can only get so far if you're not really interested in making that work with the people around you.
All right. Well, Amanda, of course, thank you again so much. I can't imagine how many hours of work you put into all of this. It's definitely appreciated by me. And I'm presuming the listeners, I mean, they're listening still at this point. You have to think that they're, unless they're just like rage listening. I think they probably appreciate.
Angie Kantz prepared me for the fact that I had a boring topic. So anybody who's interested, I appreciate.
Good. Well, hopefully, if people were going to be bored by this, we scared them away with the title and that they didn't deserve to hear everything that you had to say.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay. Amanda, if people want to reach out to you on social media, do you want to give out Twitter or anything?
Sure. I do have a Twitter. I use it kind of sparingly, but I check from time to time. So if you at me, I will see it. And I'm at A Rabinow. It's A-R-A-B-I-N-O-W.
Okay.
So you can find me there.
All right. You also were featured in the Hot Takeoff. You say that Colton should get a third chance to play Survivor. Was there anything that you stumbled upon in your research that made you feel like, you know what? I think that people have the wrong idea about him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the clinical psychologist in me who, you know, sees a young guy and thinks that, you know, he could benefit from a little bit more life experience and maybe some time, you know, on the across the couch in therapy. And I think that, you know, he could be a very nice young man and I would like to see him on Survivor once again.
Okay. Amanda, do you have a hashtag for this discussion?
Oh, my God. Oh, hashtag, what about hashtag terror management?
Okay, hashtag terror management. I think that gets you on a list when you start using as a hashtag.
Okay, I don't know, Rob. You're the hashtag expert.
hashtag cognitive dissonance are us. Is that too long?
let's give it a try.
All right, how about long, CDUS? But... That'll be the hashtag.
CDRS.
That's right. Great job. All right, Amanda, thank you so much for going through all of this with us. Definitely looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments. I think that this probably will begin a lot of different conversations. Hopefully, they all go positively in the comment section. I like to put them on notice once in a while, Amanda. All right. Thanks again for listening. You can subscribe for more Rob Has a Podcast. RobHasAWebsite.com/iTunes. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.